From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the Washington Post military correspondent Tom Ricks about his latest trip to Iraq. He'll tell us why senior military commanders there now say the key threat facing the U.S. effort in Iraq isn't terrorists, it's the intransigence of the Shiite-dominated government. Ricks is also the author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. Also today, doing Hamlet with a Hangover and other stories from Christopher Plummer. He became famous as Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music, and more recently has been in The Insider, Syriana, and Inside Man. He stars in the new independent film, Man in the Chair. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The number of weekly attacks in Iraq has fallen, and that's good news. But according to my guest, Tom Ricks, the larger story is more complex than it may seem. Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. He's been reporting from Washington and Iraq. His latest trip to Iraq was November 2nd through the 10th. Tom Ricks, welcome back to Fresh Air. Reports have just come out about how violence is down in Iraq, a 55% drop in attacks since the launch of the surge 9 months ago. The purpose of the surge was to create a more peaceful atmosphere so that the political process could move forward. So the surge was effective, apparently, in decreasing violence. Has it been effective in moving the political process forward?
I think the surge definitely has had that tactical effect of improving security. But judged on the terms in which the president presented it last January, saying that we were doing this to improve security in order to have a breathing space for political reconciliation, judged on those terms, the surge has failed.
Well, let me read something that you wrote in a recent article. You report that senior military commanders now say that the biggest threat facing the U.S. effort in Iraq isn't al-Qaeda terrorists or Sunni insurgents or Iranian-backed militias. It's the intransigence of Iraq's Shiite-dominated government. In what areas has the government been so extreme or uncompromising that the military now considers the government the big problem?
This was really striking to me. I think this is probably the single biggest sort of memory or image I took away from this trip to Iraq, was just how frustrated the American military is growing with the government that we helped create in Baghdad. I was having lunch one day with two officers in the mess hall of the 1st Cavalry Division at Camp Liberty, west of Baghdad. And the more I listened to them, the more I realized they talked more sympathetically about the former insurgents than they did about our so-called allies in the Baghdad government. And I pointed this out to them at the end of the lunch, and they said, well, yeah. They said, you know, the insurgents kind of did what they had to do. But these guys in the Baghdad government are really frustrating us. And you heard this again and again. I heard this again and again from commanders that they're worried that they've created an opportunity through the blood and sweat and treasure of the American people and their offspring. Over the last 6 months, security has improved, but that the Baghdad government is not willing to take advantage of that, is not reaching out to the Sunnis, is not reciprocating the Sunni gestures that say, hey, just give us a place at the table. We understand we lost this situation, but let us be part of the future of Iraq. What they're finding is the Baghdad government is saying, hey, politics in this country is a zero-sum game. You lose, you get nothing.
So the way you're describing it, the decrease in violence in Iraq over the past 9 months and the growing suspicion between Shia and Sunnis are kind of flip sides of the same coin. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to underplay the change in security in Iraq. I think it's very important. I think I've lost track of how many trips I've made to Iraq. It's at least 10. This was the first trip I've been on in which security was better than on my previous trip. This is the first time that the situation felt better. For example, when I was in Iraq last spring, I was in the green zone and counted 20 mortars hitting or rockets hitting the green zone. On this entire trip, I only heard 7 mortar shells the whole time. I used to hear a car bomb at least once a day. This trip, I only heard, I think, 1 bomb go off in 8 days I was there. I used to hear 50 or 100 rounds of automatic weapons fire, machine gun fire. This trip, I heard maybe 10 rounds a day. So it is much better. That said, I keep on thinking of a remark that a general said to me, General Barbero, one of the senior American commanders. He said, Iraq was never as bad as it was, and it's not as good as it's being reported now. That is to say, yes, there have been improvements, but inside the military, there are a lot of worries that you could really lose these improvements, especially if the Baghdad government doesn't get off the dime. And so they're worried that every day you have improved security without political movement is another day lost that we'll never get back.
Tom, you write that the military approach in Iraq this year has been to focus on striking deals with Sunni insurgents under which they stop fighting Americans and instead protect their own neighborhoods. Would you describe what kind of deals these are, you know, like how they're arranged, what they are?
It's very murky, and the American commanders really don't talk much about them. partly because, as they recognize, a lot of these people are not what we would call the good guys. A lot of these people they're cutting deals with are people who have killed American troops. In a sense, it's like going into South Central L.A. and giving badges to the Crips and saying, okay, you guys are now part of the local police. And part of the problem with this is that the Prime Minister of Iraq doesn't like these deals and is kind of undermining them a bit. We say, here's a bunch of former insurgents who have signed up to become policemen in this town, and they find that the Baghdad government drags its feet in enrolling these people. We are giving them a lot of money. I was just reading today through some documents. We have this thing called SERP funds, C-E-R-P is the acronym. They're given to American commanders on the ground. I think it's called Commander's Emergency Reconstruction Program funding. We've given Iraq, we've spent in Iraq $2.3 billion under that program. A lot of that money has gone to these local sheikhs, who might also be insurgent leaders, as a kind of way of cutting deals with them. And we're giving them money. They like that. They also are finding that we are willing to work with them in a way the Baghdad government isn't. But it leads to this odd situation where we are now, in some ways, our American officers are proving to be more sympathetic to these former insurgents than they are to the Baghdad government.
Have we done this with al-Qaeda in Iraq? And does that explain why al-Qaeda in Iraq's attacks have so greatly diminished?
I don't think we've done it with al-Qaeda in Iraq. What the Americans tried to do was draw a sharp distinction between what they called reconcilables and irreconcilables. Irreconcilables were people who just really wanted to kill Americans and to stir up a civil war inside Iraq. And al-Qaeda in Iraq really falls into that group. The larger group, which is essentially Sunni insurgents who were fighting partly out of self-respect, partly because they were being paid to fight, and partly because they couldn't see any other way to get a place at the table in the post-Saddam Hussein Iraq. For all those reasons, they were fighting. At the same time, the Americans said these guys could be drawn into some sort of negotiations and some sort of deals. And they have been in large numbers. It began in Anbar province and has spread somewhat. It actually began when some local sheikhs and insurgents went to the Americans and said, hey, you may see us attacking a building this afternoon. Please don't use your airplanes to strike at us. We're not attacking your people. We're going after al-Qaeda. And the Americans stood back first a couple of times and said, okay, let's watch this. This is interesting. And then there were some conversations. Hey, if you guys are genuinely interested in fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Americans said, can we help you out here? And there actually were some deals back and forth, some information sharing. The Americans, I think, were able to say, okay, we have satellites. We can give you images of that compound where the al-Qaeda guys are if you want to go after them. And I think it kind of grew out of that kind of temporary alliance on the battlefield. At one point in Baghdad, some insurgents were fighting al-Qaeda and went to the Americans and said, we're just telling you, please don't shoot at us. We're having a fight here. The Americans said, we'd like to help you out. And they actually started fighting side by side against al-Qaeda because the insurgents were getting hit pretty hard by al-Qaeda. And then some American advisors came in to work with these former insurgents. And the insurgents said, no, we don't want to work with you. We want to work with the American troops we've been fighting alongside. So the various sort of handshake deals were arrived at, and that's kind of where it's at now. The question is, how long will these handshake deals last? Will the Sunnis lose faith in this approach? And will the war change into something else that we don't know over the next 6 months?
So you've outlined two different strategies that the American military in Iraq has used to decrease the violence. One was to align itself with Sunnis who were fighting al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the other is to cut deals with insurgents so that they get some money, they get to police their own neighborhoods in return for stopping their part of the insurgency. Are these things that mainly account for the dramatic decrease in violence that we've seen in Iraq?
They account for a very big part of the decrease in violence, but another part of the decrease comes from the simple fact that Baghdad is essentially an ethnically cleansed city at this point. It's much less of a mixed city than it was a couple of years ago, and lots of neighborhoods that used to be overwhelmingly Sunni are now overwhelmingly Shiite. And the fighting for those neighborhoods has stopped. The Sunnis simply have left. 2 million people have fled the country. That's almost 10% of the population of the country. And one of the worries is next year, if security continues to improve, a lot of the Sunnis might come back. They're running out of money from their exile in Jordan or Syria or Egypt, and they do want to come home. The problem is their homes are now occupied by Shiite squatters. And when these Sunnis come back and say, I want my old house back, what will the Iraqi security forces do? Remember, the Iraqi security forces, the police and army, are overwhelmingly Shiite, especially the police. And the police have acted frequently in a sectarian manner, as if they were simply the biggest Shiite militia around. And so it's a really open question, and one that American planners are already worried about. What happens when the Sunnis come home and say, we want our houses back?
So even if there's some stability now, that there's so many ways that that can be ended by the next turn of events.
This is actually one of the themes that American commanders emphasized to me in my interviews with them, which is this is far from over, and it probably looks a little bit better in a situation than it really is. They can see a lot of ways that it can go wrong, and they can only see a couple of ways that it could go right. And the big worry is simply that this opportunity that's presented itself, they feel they've kind of opened a window of opportunity with these moves to improve security. The big worry is that that simply is going to slip by, and Iraq will slide back down the hill into the mess it was in for all of 2006. And every time that happens, it's harder to get back out of that situation. There's a lot of people who feel that Uncle Sam has made these promises now, you know, and said, we're going to help you find a place in the future Iraq. But if Uncle Sam isn't able to force the Shiite government to reach out and show a little bit of generosity of spirit, I think the Sunnis might become quite bitter. The other problem is provincial elections. The Americans see provincial elections as the only way to really start having political progress. They've kind of given up on the Maliki government really reconciling itself in any fashion to the Shiites. The problem with provincial elections is they're going to be bloody, they're going to be rough, and so it's going to make Iraq look more violent. So do you want to do it right now or in the next few months when you still have a lot of these so-called surge troops around, the 5 extra combat brigades that were moved in this year? Or do you wait and let the sense of security seep in more and let Iraqis enjoy a breather of sorts? And do you wait until maybe next fall? The problem with that is, do you lose the Sunnis while you wait? And also, you wind up holding the elections, which are going to be nasty, on the eve of the American presidential election. And it means that in September and October of 2008, you might have bloody scenes of Iraq all over the evening news again, which is certainly not something the Republicans would like to see.
My guest is Tom Ricks, military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Ricks. He's the Washington Post military correspondent, and he just got back from Iraq. He was there from November 2nd through November 10th. There's currently an investigation into Blackwater, a private military contractor that was providing security to American diplomats and others in Iraq. And, you know, they're being accused of having fired on and killed several Iraqi civilians without cause. What is the reaction that you heard in the American military to the reliance that we've had in this war on private military contractors who aren't accountable to the military?
This actually came up a lot in conversations, frequently initiated by officers rather than me. What you find is a real loathing and contempt for Blackwater and the other private security contractors, a feeling that they're a bunch of cowboys. And then they come in to an area an American commander is trying to deal with, and they mess things up, and you don't know they're there. They don't coordinate. They don't tell you they're coming through. And most of all, that they don't have the best interest of the country in mind. All they're there is to make a buck by executing their contract, and their contract is to keep their principal alive, to perform their bodyguard function at the expense of everything else. American troops know that sometimes you might have to die in the course of your duty rather than, say, kill a bunch of kids. And they really make sacrifices in executing their duty. And they're very unhappy when they see these guys cowboying it up, as the term they use, acting like a bunch of cowboys. I was actually talking to a brigade commander about this, and I said, would you want the responsibility of having these guys in your chain of command, of having to discipline them? And he said, absolutely. He said, it would be a lot of extra work to try to keep these tabs on these guys, but it's a lot better than having them just shoot through my, what he calls my battle space, my area, without me knowing about it and messing up the area and maybe undercutting my progress. I think that the security contractor situation has really come into relief this year, though, because for years, some American units acted in a way not unlike the way the security contractors act. They would shoot up any cars that came close to them. They kind of shot first and asked questions later. Under General Petraeus, the American troops are operating very differently. They've been told explicitly by General Petraeus that their top priority is protecting the Iraqi people. And that's a real change from the American posture of, say, 03-04. So now you have a situation where the way Blackwater operates is in sharp contrast to American operations. And I think it's really cast a harsh new light on the contractors that has taken them by surprise.
There are a lot of troops in Iraq who have been held over, two or three times? Am I exaggerating the number?
Well, they've done two or three tours, but what they have now is their tours are being extended from 12 months to 15 months. And a lot of people out there are doing 15 months now, 15-month tours of duty.
From what you could tell on your recent trip to Iraq, how are troops reacting to that?
I was struck at the variations in morale. Overall, I'm surprised at how good morale is in the U.S. military. If you had told me 5 years ago what they would go through, and without any increase in the size of the military, with only 1% of the American population carrying the burden of this war, you told me all that, I would have predicted plummeting morale in the military. It's been a surprise to me that actually morale has been as good as it is. That said, I do think morale is sinking in certain parts of the military. This was the first trip I've been on in which more than one officer spontaneously brought up with me in an interview the issue of morale of the troops around them, saying, I'm seeing poor morale. This wasn't universal. It was far from universal. I think morale still generally is pretty good. But in certain units, people said morale is really bad here. These extra 3 months on our second tour here are really disturbing families. Wives back home are saying, you got to make a choice, me or the Army. You're also seeing it in captains. One thing I found, I asked whenever I was interviewing a captain, I'd say, are you planning on staying in? And every single captain I asked said no. And I'd say, are any of your friends staying in? And a couple of captains said, no, every friend of mine as a captain is planning on leaving too. That's worrying a lot of people in the Army.
Is it just Army captains who are not re-upping? Like, why did you single them out?
Well, it's Army captains in particular who are punching out. West Point graduates have a 5-year service obligation, so they can't leave as second lieutenants or first lieutenants, usually. They're usually captains by the time they can get out. And so a lot of them are saying, that's it, I'm out of here. In fact, I'm told that the departure rate for Army officers who graduated from West Point is skyrocketing. It is much higher than it was, say, 10 or 15 years ago. It's also the age at which people have to start making decisions about whether they're going to make a career inside the military. If you've been in 5, 7, 10 years, you're probably in your late 20s, early 30s. And it's still easy to make the transition from there and say, go to business school, go to law school, get on with another career. It's much harder if you're, say, 40. And at that point, you've been in 15, 18 years. Why not stay until you've been in 20 and get the full retirement benefits? So there's a couple of demographic reasons that force people to start making decisions about the time that they're captains, about whether to stay in. The surprising thing is how many people are saying, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm leaving. And it's something you hear a lot of worry about inside the Army.
Anything else you want to share with us before our time is up?
If anything, I think just the sense of being in the air in Iraq right now. It's not like people are walking around talking about how happy they are. They're all walking on eggshells now. They're really tired in Iraq. They've been going through this really agonizing experience for 4 years, coming off of living under Saddam Hussein. The last 5 years have been especially bad for them because they thought it was over, and it wasn't. And it actually, for many of them, life got much worse. So I was really struck when I talked to Iraqis I knew and I'd seen before, just how on edge they seemed. They want to be hopeful, but they've had their hopes dashed so many times that they're almost more nervous now than they've been in the past. It's one thing to know you're going to be shot at today. It sort of focuses you. But if you're hoping things are getting better, if you're trying to figure out, do I bring my family back now? These are sort of a bunch of agonizing new questions, and they really don't know. Is this simply a lull, or is this the beginning of a new, better phase of life for them? And so I think there's a lot of new anxiety I sensed at the same time that they're kind of saying, things, you know, are getting better, cross your fingers.
Well, Tom Rooks, good to have you back in the States, and thank you as always for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Tom Rooks is military correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the bestseller Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from John and Catherine Debs, funding the Bay Area Women's and Children's Center, providing service to low-income families at bawcc.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a ridiculous story from the early days of live TV drama from a man who's made over 100 films, Christopher Plummer. He was Captain Von Trapp in the film The Sound of Music, and more recently has been in The Insider, Syriana, Inside Man, and did the voiceover for a Grand Theft Auto video game. He stars in the new independent film, Man in the Chair. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you say Christopher Plummer, some people automatically think Captain Von Trapp in The Sound of Music. Well, that's just one of about 100 films Plummer has made. His recent films include The Insider, A Beautiful Mind, Syriana, and Inside Man. He's also had a long stage career, won 2 Tonys, and performed with Britain's National Theatre and the Royal Shakespeare Company. Plummer has several films about to come out, including Man in the Chair, an independent film in which he plays Flash, the last living crew member who worked on Citizen Kane. He's a bitter, cranky, alcoholic old man who's befriended by a high school student trying to win a filmmaking competition. Together, Flash and some of his fellow retired film friends help the kid make a movie. In this scene, Flash is showing the kid photos in a hidden room in an old Hollywood studio lot. The kid is played by Michael Angarano.
So this place was like a clubhouse?
Yeah, sort of. But it was a tough club to get into. No above-the-line wankers, that's for sure.
Above the line?
Producers, directors, writers, actors, those creeps.
So you know all these people?
Most of them. A lot of them are dead. Yeah, but these are my friends. Hey, that's me with the crew of Citizen Kane.
You worked on Citizen Kane?
Yeah, it's the skinny guy in the middle.
So amazing. Is Orson Welles there?
These are crew-only photos, for Christ's sake.
Oh, so no directors, no wankers?
Right.
Always wanted to be a wanker. Director.
A director, huh? The man in the chair, huh?
Yes.
You guess. The man in the chair can't ever be a guesser. He's got to make decisions. You know, boom, 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 boom. He's got to know what he's doing. Frank Capra says, if you're half right, you'll be a genius.
Christopher Plummer, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe your character in Man in the Chair?
Oh, I think he was a wonderful old drunk, which I was for many years myself. So research was not a problem in my case. He was a gaffer on Citizen Kane, but spends most of his time drinking and prowling around and going to cinemas, of which, of course, he's a huge authority. And he befriends this young kid who is mad to make movies himself. And their relationship grows. He becomes from grumpy, cynical, bitter old soak into someone who is now rejuvenated.
Your character in Man in the Chair has grown bitter with age. Whereas it seems to me in your life, you just keep getting better roles. You've been in a lot of interesting movies in the past few years.
Yes, I have, which is great because once I hit the character actor level, scripts started to improve as they came my way.
Is there any movie that you see as like a turning point in the latter part of your career?
Uh-huh. I think The Insider was. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I spent my life on the stage and I'd done tons of film, both in England, Europe, and here. But another level started to be reached after The Insider, and the scripts that I was receiving were now much more intelligent and of an A level rather than a B plus.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned The Insider because we just happen to have a clip from it.
Oh, whoop.
Yeah, and this film, for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's about The Insider is played by Russell Crowe. He's a whistleblower who had worked as a scientist at a tobacco company. And he knows all the secrets about the poisonous additives and all that stuff. So he's talking to 60 Minutes about it. But this is the very beginning of the story in which your producer, Lowell Bergman, played by Al Pacino, has been setting up an interview for you with an Islamic extremist. And at this point, you step in as Mike Wallace to actually ask the questions, and you want to create the rules, but of course the Islamic group wants to create the rules. So here's how the interview gets started.
He says you must not sit so close.
What? I can't conduct an interview from back there.
You must move back your chair.
Well, you tell him that when I conduct an interview, I sit anywhere I damn please.
There is no interview.
You!
I'm
talking to you.
Ali
Sama! The hell do you think I am? A 78-year-old assassin? You think I'm going to karate him to death with this notepad?
Are you interpreting
what I'm saying?
Yes.
We're there. Good. Well, ask him if Arabic is his second language.
It's my guest, Christopher Plummer, in a scene from The Insider. How did you get the part in The Insider, which you say, you know, was a turning point in your film career?
Well, they sent me the script. I'm sure they sent it to others as well, but I got it, and I met Michael and Al, and I was in. It was just wonderful.
And did you start watching a lot of 60 Minutes? Did you meet Mike Wallace?
You know,
Was that necessary?
I knew Mike Wallace, and he'd interviewed me in the past. I also grew up with Mike Wallace. He was one of the early hardcore television personalities. And I watched him continuously when I was in my 20s, in the 50s, and when he began. And it was always very exciting to watch that kind of television. It was really probably what the medium was for, a kind of expose medium in which people got into the core, sometimes cruelly or not, of someone's persona. And Mike was an expert at it, as was John Freeman in England.
Now, another film that you did in recent years was Syriana, in which you're the head of a big law firm representing an oil company with interests in the Middle East. And they're looking at a power change in a small Gulf country, and they want their own man in power so they can call the shots. So they're trying to help this young, weaker prince who they think they can tell what to do. I want to play a scene in which you're talking with that prince.
Prince.
Is there
anything that we can do for you?
Americans always happy to drill holes in other people's countries. I've heard of you, Mr. Whiting. The cat's paw of the Saudi princes.
I know your brother, the foreign minister. He's very bright. I know your father, too. He threw the second creepiest party I've ever been to in Washington. And as far as I can see, you could probably use a bit of the cat's paw yourself. Second-born son, so beaten down by his family, he can't even tell me what he wants when he's asked straight out. A grown-up baby who's afraid of his brother? And maybe he wants to be king? Maybe? Well, Prince, are you a king? Can you tell me what you want?
Well, Christopher Plummer, hearing your scenes from The Insider and from Syriana, I just started wondering, have you ever played someone in a movie who's sweet-tempered, sensitive, and shy?
Yes, of course I have. Of course I have. I've made over 125 movies, and I think in them you'll find some of them sweet, darling, sensitive, and shy. Yeah, I have done a few of those parts, of course. And I think Flash in The Man in the Chair has a great deal of sweetness in him, too, which comes to the fore in the end, brought out by the young man.
But you seem in recent years to really have kind of specialized in those really, like, power assertive roles. No one's going to push me around kind of roles.
Yes, I guess so. King Lear and Inherit the Wind last year, playing Clarence Darrow.
On Broadway?
Yeah, both of those on Broadway. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I suppose. But those parts interest me. They're witty. They've got a wonderful edge to them. And I think people think that I exude a sort of power. So they keep casting me in these things.
My guest is Christopher Plummer. He's starring in a new film called Man in the Chair. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Plummer. He's made over 100 films and has several about to come out, including Man in the Chair. Well, we've got one more clip for you, and this one is inevitable. So, the movie that made you famous, The Sound of Music, 1965, which you were Captain Von Trapp, a widow who expects his children to behave as if they were in the military until you get a new governess, played by, of course, Julie Andrews. And this is the scene in which she comes to your door, you meet her for the first time, and you're trying to evaluate her and also give her directions on how to handle the kids.
Now, Fräulein...
Maria.
Fräulein Maria, I don't know how much the mother abbess has told you.
Not much.
You are the 12th in a long line of governesses who have come to look after my children since their mother died. I trust that you will be an improvement on the last one. She stayed only 2 hours.
What's wrong with the children, sir?
Well, there's nothing wrong with the children. Only the governesses. They were completely unable to maintain discipline. Without it, this house cannot be properly run. You will please remember that, Fräulein?
Yes, sir.
Every morning you will drill the children in their studies. I will not permit them to dream away their summer holidays. Each afternoon they will march about the grounds, breathing deeply. Bedtime is to be strictly observed, no exceptions.
Excuse me, sir, when do they play?
You will see to it that they conduct themselves at all time with the utmost orderliness and decorum. I'm placing you in command.
Yes, sir.
Christopher Plummer and Julie Andrews in a scene from The Sound of Music. People have such strong feelings about that movie. They either love it or they hate it and they think it's really insipid. Where do you stand on this issue of our time?
I'm very fond of Julie. That's the nicest thing that came out of that film for me. We have a true and great friendship. She's an extraordinary woman and professional. I'm grateful to the film in many ways because it was such a success. It is not my favorite film, of course, because I do think it borders on mawkishness, but we did our damned best not to make it too mawkish, and Robert Wise kept a very tight control on it, which was difficult enough. The sound and the music is quite wonderful. The only two countries that really didn't like it were Austria, of course, and Germany. Austria was fed to the teeth with the fact that they'd seen so many documentary films about the Trapp family that they'd had them up to here.
You know, in your movies, you have such good diction, such proper diction in some of your roles. I almost thought you were from England. You're from Canada. Is the diction a result of theater training? Is it a class thing?
No, it's to do with my family, who spoke well. I mean, we speak well in Canada as well as they do in Great Britain, may I remind you. Mm-hmm. And my family were educated, well-read, and they spoke beautiful English. So I really got a lot from them. And, of course, theater training continued to make it better.
Now, you were a member of two very famous British theater groups, the National Theater and the Royal Shakespeare Company. What years were you in England?
I lived in England from 1961 right through into almost the mid-70s.
Oh.
So about 15 years, yeah.
Okay. So you worked in a period when the method became very popular in the United States, but
yeah.
You were also doing classical theater. So you were doing classical theater and movies in which a lot of the actors were into the method. Did you find yourself going back and forth between more of a classical approach and more of a method approach to acting?
Well, I think both. I think they one helped the other. I'm so glad that... I'm so glad I was Canadian in a way, because the Canadian can take the best of the British and the best of the American school. And we're rather good at that. We're kind of like chameleons in that respect. That's why there's so many good Canadian comics and mimics. They're terrific. So that was valuable, to use the method and use the classical technique together at the same time. It was very exciting.
How would you describe the main difference between the two approaches?
The method in itself has been, I think, heavily misunderstood. I've always thought that. The method is really there for an actor who is in trouble and who can't rustle up an emotion that he's trying to get or that the author requires him to get. So he uses sense memory and things that the method suggests you use to some personal experience in his family or some tragedy. He uses that to infuse the lines that he's having trouble with. But if you're an actor, for God's sake, the whole reason for being an actor is that you have an imagination and intelligence and some sort of instinct of your own, and you don't need to follow the method.
Now, early in your screen career, you were actually on television. And you did a lot of the early TV shows.
The golden age of television, yes, in New York.
Like General Electric Theater and Kraft Theater.
Oh, yeah, all of them. I did them all, yeah.
And a lot of those were live, right? Or all of them were live?
All of them were live. Tape didn't come in until the late 50s, I don't think.
Do you have any really good stories about doing live drama on television in the 50s?
Well, yeah. I can't remember the name of the show, but Martin Manulis was the producer and director. And we were doing, this time, Meierling, the story of Crown Prince Rudolf of Habsburg and his suicide attempt with Maria Vecchera, his lover. And the setting was in the hunting lodge. And on the night of the show, live, of course, Vivica Lindfors was such a beautiful Swedish actress, and she was playing Maria Vecchera. I had an immense crush on her. And the night came before I was supposed to make my entrance into the hunting lodge, and she is waiting for me. And the poor thing had to wait and wait and wait because off stage, I couldn't see anything. It was all black, and I couldn't find the door to come in. I didn't know where it was, and there was no stage manager or anybody to help me. So finally, I saw a light at the end of this long sort of black hole, and I thought, oh, thank God, at last I can find an entrance and make my entrance. So I sort of bent down and came out of it. But the audience must have been very startled to see Crown Prince Rudolf with all his medals coming out through the fireplace. And Manulis just screamed at me. He said, what the hell, after it was over, he said, what the hell did you come in there for? I said, you got goddamn lucky I came in at all. Don't speak to me like that. I've been spending hours looking for this friggin' entrance.
So what'd you do to cover it up? Anything?
No, we just valiantly went over there. But her face was something extraordinary. She didn't dream I was going to come through that thing.
That sounds such a nightmare, though. You know, it's like live TV and you can't find the entrance to the stage.
Oh, it's awful. But the cameramen were so great in those days because I was on a long soap opera once, and it was so bad I can't remember its name and refuse to remember its name. But they were so great. There were only four of them, you know, four cameras. And then we never knew our lines. So that when we forgot a line, we'd wink at the cameraman, and the cameraman would then go and shoot a vase or something on a table or a grand piano. And while we quickly looked at the script and nodded, and then he came back and we finished the scene. But that happened all the time. But it was beautiful. They'd mastered it so smoothly, these cameramen. They were heroes.
Did stuff like that make you more fearless on stage because you'd experienced such traumatic things on TV?
Well, of course. If you put yourself in disaster, it's the best training of all, isn't it? You know how to get yourself out of trouble. I've never been frightened on the stage, though. It's always, for some crazy reason, I felt very much at home on stage.
Now, you've performed Shakespeare as a young man. You've performed Shakespeare as an older man, most recently as King Lear on Broadway. Does Shakespeare read differently to you now than it did when you were young? Are there things you see in it now that you didn't then, or interpretations that are different?
Well, of course there are, but the poet himself remains as magical and as extraordinary and as simple and as human as he did when I was young, because that's what strikes you right away, is the humanity of the plays when and the simplicity of them. When you're a young person, that's why he's head and shoulders above all the other writers that wrote at his time, particularly, because they're much more florid and grandiloquent, and Shakespeare is so extraordinarily simple, and that stays with you always. Of course, as you grow older and you have some experience of life, you see more into the depths of each character. King Lear, for instance, which is an extraordinary play. It's so very modern in its dysfunctional family and all the trappings of power that are disappearing from. I mean, it's so modern. It's so human. It's a great piece of work, I must say.
So you
need to be much older to understand the depths of a part like that.
I never think of Shakespeare as being simple.
Oh, yes. Come on. When he picks the great moments, the key moments in plays, his language becomes terribly simple. You notice that.
Give me an example.
Well, I mean, nothing could be simpler than the rest is silence. That's as modern a statement as there ever was.
My guest is Christopher Plummer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Christopher Plummer. He's made over 100 films and has several about to come out, including Man in the Chair. Your first marriage was to Tammy Grimes, and you had a daughter together, the actress Amanda Plummer.
Yes.
Who, among other things, was one of the stars of Pulp Fiction. Were you particularly proud to see her in such a kind of landmark movie?
Well, I was prouder to see her on stage give one of the most extraordinary performances I've ever seen in the theater, and I'm not saying that because she's my daughter. Agnes of God, which she won all the prizes for. She was just an extraordinary demon on that stage and took the audience with her, and I knew that she had an extraordinary sort of greatness in her when she acted that role, and so did all the critics. She is immensely talented. She's very eccentric. She's dangerous on the stage. And on screen. I think she has a danger, and she never stops working. She's making all sorts of interesting little films, some which are never seen because they're so obscure. But she'll travel everywhere to do one. She's an amazing creature, and I'm very proud of her altogether. I think her particular talent has nothing to do with us in a funny way. She's got a totally different approach to performing, and it's when I watch her, I envy her because it makes me feel very rather old-fashioned, and I kind of quite miserable actually. She startles me and startles people.
You said at the beginning of the interview, the character that you play in your new movie, Man in the Chair, that you used to drink a lot.
Yes.
That was a very enthusiastic yes. Was this mostly like in the 1950s and 60s?
Yeah, that was the good drinking era. Then the 60s sort of became more of a drug era, didn't it? And then the 70s were so boring I can't remember them. But the 50s was a very communicative era. Everybody loved their drink. New York was wide open, so was Montreal. In fact, Montreal stayed open 24 hours a day. There wasn't a joint in town that closed. And I used to, you know, commute shuttle back from both. It was a glorious time, and we were all us young actors, my friends, Jason Robards, were all big drinkers, Richard Harris, Peter O'Toole. All of us were good hard-fisted drinkers, and our intention was that we should be, if we were to be called men, we must be drink as much as we can, and if we can still get through Hamlet the next day without a hitch, that made you a man, my son. That you weren't worth anything unless you could do the test of time.
Is it harder to do Hamlet with a hangover?
Terrible. It's just a nightmare, and I have done it with a hangover, yeah. It was very fast, though. We did it very fast. We got off very quickly. It was no longer a 3.5-hour, 4-hour play. It was something like 2 hours.
What would you do to make yourself feel better before having to do Hamlet or any kind of heavy lifting with a hangover?
Fernabranca was my favorite pick-me-up. Fernet Branca laced with a little creme de menthe. It, it goes down like silk, and boy, does it wake you up. And if you have another one, if you have two or three Fernet Brancas, you're drunk again. So just stick to one and you'll be okay.
And you wouldn't forget your lines with that?
No, somehow Hamlet remained intact in my memory. It was such a glorious play that I wouldn't insult it by forgetting it.
Are there any roles you'd still particularly like to play? There's a lot of roles you don't know about because they haven't been written yet, but is there any particular thing you have your sights on?
Well, I hope somebody actually does write some role that really is a wonderful role. There aren't many. It's an ensemble time now. And as Nathan Lane said so succinctly, I don't do ensemble. but, yeah, there's tons of stuff I want to play. I want to play some Chekhov. I'm going to play some Shaw coming up, which I'm very excited about, Caesar and Cleopatra. And, yes, I want to do things like Prospero. I want to do Volpone. I've got tons of parts that I want to play before I croak.
Well, Christopher Plummer, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Plummer stars in the film Man in the Chair, which comes out next month. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Ian Chilog, Joan Tui Westman, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think, by food psychologist Brian Wansink. More at mindlesseating.org. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication. On the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nellie Mackay joins us to perform some old and new original songs, plus a song from the Three Penny Opera. She co-starred in the recent production with Alan Cumming and Cyndi Lauper. Mackay has a new CD called Obligatory Villagers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Should you plan to travel way down south?
Whoa.
Woman to woman, I gotta tell you about.